Friends, that's Lashana Haba. That's the end of the Seder. I hope I didn't spoil the movie for you. You can still go to Seder, but that's how it ends. next year, we'll all be in Jerusalem together, a city of peace for all the Jews and for all humanity, where we can all peace can flourish and pour forth throughout the world. But again, I hope you'll still go to Seder, even though you know the ending now. In any case, friends, if you are new to the program, this is our 10 greatest Jewish ideas to offer the world. And as a slight recap of where we've been so far on this journey together, we started with the topic that everything matters, right? That the potential for spirituality is not confined to one space in our lives, but rather it's not just what we do, but how we do things that matter, how we do everything in our lives, that everything matters in terms of who of ourselves we bring to wherever we go. That there's no spaces that matter and spaces that don't. The second topic was repair is possible, that nothing and nobody is irredeemable. But that we can fix problems, we can solve problems, people can heal, people can grow, our societies can transform. Our third topic, where we were slaves in Egypt, a reminder of this vehicle for empathy, this transformative capacity for compassion and for seeing other people in the world rooted in this narrative of our own traumas, intergenerational traumas. And here we get to session four of body and soul. Which of those is primary? So now let's move to a poll question to get our juices flowing. Hopefully you're enjoying some juice over there. On body and soul, number one, we are primarily our bodies. Number two, and option four, we are equally body and soul. Okay, what do you think we are as human beings? What are we primarily? Wow, there's never a week I'm not astounded. Nobody here says we are primarily our bodies. Actually, that is surprising to me because I think that is a prevailing view today. 21% say we are primarily our souls. Very interesting. 7% say neither of these. If you're willing to admit who you are, maybe you'll write in the chat what you think we are if we're not body or soul. But again, if you don't want to, you're welcome to pass on that. We have no way of discovering who you are. I mean, we couldn't even convict O.J. Simpson. How can we figure out, who here voted for that? So, and 71% say we are equally body and soul. That we are both body and soul and that both matter is a profoundly Jewish idea. It's also by no means a given, as many ideologies tend to prioritize one over the other. In our modern culture, for example, we see an obsession with the body. So often our worth is determined by the aesthetics of our bodies, making body image not just a personal issue, but a societal one. An estimated 9% of the US population, 9%, that's 28.8 million people, will have an eating disorder in their lifetime. As well, our society is fixated on body pleasure in addition to body image. Some have called the 2020s a new age of hedonism in reference to the prevailing attitude of pleasure seeking. Even the way many people talk about the afterlife refers to the body and its capacity for pleasure, and in a way that suggests that the body is almost essential to what makes us human. On the other hand, we know there's other ideologies that diminish the value of the body and make primary the soul. Many religions have a tradition of asceticism in which a person denies their own physical needs in order to attain spiritual growth. These practices often include long-term fasting, celibacy, vows of poverty, and even self-flagellation. In such ideologies, not only is the soul superior to the body, but the body is a threat to the soul. This viewpoint is famously characterized in the Christian Gospels. Indeed, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. That's the New Testament, Matthew 26:41. Asceticism has never been a dominant theme in Judaism. Rather, Judaism sees the body and the soul as both wedded and important in their own right. This concept is beautifully illustrated in a 14th century commentary by Bachia ben Asher, also known as Rabbeinu Bachia, Spanish scholar in the Middle Ages. In Parshat Ki Tissa, we learn that all of Bnei Israel are required to contribute a half shekel, chetzi shekel, as an offering to the Mishkan, to the sanctuary. Rabbeinu Bachia spends a lot of time puzzling over this strange amount. Why a half shekel? Why not a whole shekel? Because he offers, we are half body and half soul. Each person weighs their actions in life so as to give due weight to their spiritual needs as to their physical needs. A Jew, Rabbeinu Bachia writes, has a dual duty to look after both the body and the soul. Essentially, we need both of these halves, the mind and the body, because the mind is part of the body and the mind, those who treat the mind as something beyond the body. Rabbeinu Bachia continues by bringing in a Talmudic teaching attributed to Rabbi Yehoshua that the festival days are half of us and half for God, meaning half the holiday is for eating, drinking, and resting. The other half of the holiday is for connecting with the divine. So I'm not going to call anybody out here, but if your Passover Seder is the type where you open the book for 5 minutes and then you eat for 4 hours, you might want to get a better balance in the mix. On the other hand, if your Seder is the type where you read the book for 4 hours and only eat for 20 minutes, you might want to get a better mix in place. The idea here is that the holidays are half kind of beyond this world and half within this world, half of the soul and half of the body. This interplay between the physical and the spiritual is evidenced all over our tradition. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the founder of the 19th century Musar movement, famously asserted that paying attention to the physical needs of others is an actual part of the spiritual path. In a teaching that would be echoed by the Jewish philosopher Emmanuel Levinas, Rabbi Salanter taught, the material needs of another are my spiritual needs. That is to say, what do I do to be spiritual? Well, not just go pray or meditate. I go be a doctor. I go deliver food to the homeless. When I'm addressing other people's bodies, that's actually me being spiritual, is what they're saying. We might contrast this approach with the many religions that have dismissed the physical welfare of people in order to influence their supposed spiritual welfare. Focusing on converting people or theologically influencing people rather than focusing on feeding them and housing them. Rabbi Salanter reminds us that the path of Musar, that is to say of our own spiritual growth, is in acts of caring for others' bodies and material needs. In this way, the other person's physical needs present to us a spiritual possibility. There's a story about the great mystic Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the 18th century founder of the Chabad movement known as the Alter Rebbe or the Baal HaTanya, that I think is relevant here. One night, this Rebbe was awoken by the sound of his grandson crying. When he went downstairs, Rabbi Zalman found his son studying intently, apparently so intently that he had not heard a baby crying. So the grandfather went into his grandson's bedroom and comforted the baby until it could once again fall asleep. Later, Rabbi Zalman confronted his son. My child, I don't know what you are studying, but it cannot be the word of God if it makes you deaf to the cry of a child. Our spiritual paths should never be considered superior to or even set those around us. He's teaching his kid, I don't know what Torah or Talmud you're studying. If you can't hear it, it's valueless. So how do we translate this half shekel split between body and soul into our daily lives? The logistics of dividing our time evenly are quite difficult. It's not particularly reasonable to say, all right, I'm going to split my time exactly 50-50. For half the day, I'll meditate and pray and learn Torah and join VBM classes. Okay, all right, maybe the last one you should do. But for the other half of the day, I'm going to eat, I'm going to eat, sleep, rest, stretch, and take care of my finances. Perhaps there are people who can live like that. More power to them. But for the common person, certainly including myself, that would be an impossibly demanding schedule to adhere to. I also think that such a schema loses sight of the true essence of the relationship between mind and body in Judaism. We're not talking just about time allocation. Rather, we're dealing with a constant dual consciousness. We do not need to perfectly split our time between the spiritual and the physical. Rather, we are charged to remain aware of the spiritual aspects in the physical world and the physical aspects of the spiritual path. Let's say I'm somebody who enjoys playing 4 hours of golf, you know, three times a week. Or I'm someone who enjoys playing 2 hours of pickleball every day, right? We might say, oh, well, that's going to be my physical time because I'm golfing or I'm playing pickleball. Or we might say, right, there's an elevated spiritual consciousness I have while I'm on the greens, while I'm on the court. And actually, this is a physical and a spiritual time. So too, one might say that when one is engaged in something that's deemed purely spiritual, that there's a physical dimension to such an activity as well. How do we have this dual consciousness? By placing value and even holiness in the bodies of others, we're being offered a spiritual path. To be sure, also, that was what Rav Kook was offering the religious Zionists with serving in the Israeli army. The Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox, said, you don't serve in the army. Why would you do that? You're going to take time away from learning Torah? You should be involved in the spiritual, not the physical. And Rav Kook and other religious Zionists came in back and said, actually, when you're physically serving in the army, you're engaged in a spiritual act of defending your people from attack. And if you hold that dual consciousness, and you're also engaged in the spiritual act of holding your values in place while you're also on the front lines. And so that's another kind of interesting example of the combination as opposed to the Haredi approach, which said, you know, just learn. With this mentality, the food insecurity faced by a staggering 15 million Americans is of concern to my soul, right? Hunger in America is not just a physical problem, it's a spiritual problem. Therefore, volunteering at a food pantry or with a mutual aid organization that distributes meals is in fact spiritual work. This is also a guiding principle in how we relate to ourselves and to our bodies. How might we approach our physical needs as entwined with the needs of our souls? The writer Octavia F. Rahim, who we see here, advocates for rest as a sacred act in her book, Rest is Sacred. Our own tradition teaches us that Shabbat, with its rest and abundant meals, is a taste of the world to come. Instead of considering our own physical needs to be at odds with our spiritual path, we might come to see them as in concert with one another. Friends, this is a pretty radical idea. We're going to get to Shabbat later. But the idea that Shabbat, the most spiritual day of the week, is actually a day where we take naps and we eat special foods and have some drinks or whatever we're going to do that's going to feel good. Even marital relations is considered an extra mitzvah on Shabbat. All these physical things on the most spiritual of days. I think it's a deep insight. Remembering that we are both body and soul also contains an important lesson in limits. In a sense, the soul is limitless. It's the part of the self that lives in potentiality with infinite opportunity for soaring beyond, transcending the limitations of everyday life. Whereas the body reminds us of our concrete limits. As we age, we all know when we feel back pain or our knees start to go out or we get migraines or other things that start to happen as we age, we start to learn our limits in our aging. We can dream, but we need sleep. We can strive for an ideal world, but we need to take care of ourselves. We can philosophize around the highest moral ideals, but we need to make sure we're considering the conditions on the ground. Together, the body and soul put checks on one another, ensuring that we are both realistic and idealistic. I want to be clear, friends, that what I'm proposing here is not merely to find a balance between two concerns. Rather, I'm suggesting a form of harmonization, not balance, but harmonization. This goes beyond tension. Although there are, of course, times when there is tension between body and soul, ideally we will move beyond that tension into a collaborative state where the sum is greater than its parts. Consider, for example, two instruments playing together or two people singing a duet. The combined effect of both parts goes beyond the individual contributions of each musician, because together they create an entirely new piece of music that transcends its constituent parts. In physics, this concept is called emergence. When a system is composed of many parts, an emergent property of that system will be a property that none of the individual parts have on their own. It's as if 2 + 2 = 5. So too, the interplay between body and soul results in a greater whole. Again, friends, I'm not suggesting an absence of tension. There's indeed a tension between body and soul, tension which we must learn to navigate and in a sense learn to balance. However, when we learn to submit to both body and soul in their distinct necessity and beauty, we allow them to make music together. Another way to imagine this complex duality is in the concept of light. Our bodies unequivocally need sunlight to survive. Sunlight boosts our supply of vitamin D, without which our genes cannot properly regulate our tissue, resulting in an inability to absorb calcium. Without outdoor sun exposure, humans tend to become vitamin D deficient, greatly increasing the risk of fractures, bone pain, falls, and in children, rickets. These are scientific facts. However, there's also a spiritual dimension of light beyond its physical effects on our body that we need. In Tanakh, light is deeply metaphorical. Proverbs tells us a mitzvah is a candle and the Torah is light. Elsewhere in Proverbs, the human soul is described as a lit candle. In Ecclesiastes, wisdom is likened to light. And in Psalms, it is God whom we call my light. Light, therefore, has both material and spiritual properties that humans need. We would not say that we need to balance the tension between the physical and spiritual in light. Rather, we might instead say that these properties inform one another, giving our sense of what light means more depth and possibility. Tangentially, but not so tangentially, one of the things that that keeps me up at night with the hostages is not just that they have no clue if they're going to survive, not only their mental illness, not only the physical torture they're going through, but the lack of light they experience, right? Being in solitary confinement, being in the darkest place when our bodies need light, again, spiritually and physically, is just an added level of suffering. Regarding the materiality of the soul, there's a whole debate as to where the soul resides. The late antiquity philosopher Galen located the soul in the heart. Descartes located the soul in the pineal gland. Today, the most common assertion is that the soul lives in the brain. This is the same reasoning that leads people to deny the soul exists at all, as to them, there's only the brain and nothing more. Others might suggest that what we call the soul is the result of happenings in the brain that are beyond our explanation, such as an approach might be said to entwine body and soul completely, with the brain as the physical body and the soul as the loftier, immaterial thought dimension of the body. If, however, we take the approach that the soul is not physical in any way, that it has no specific site in the body, but rather is precisely that which transcends the brain and all physicality, then we must work harder to bridge the two. It is in such work, I believe, that we move towards a more profound understanding of ourselves. As we move towards eschatology, we might consider how a culture treats death as an effective indicator of that culture's attitudes towards the body and the soul. Today, it's more and more popular to engage in cremation. If I say anything judgmental here about burial, forgive me. I'm going to say something, you know, slightly critical about cremation, but I have a personal attachment to, and that my mother of blessed memory, who passed away 9 months ago, chose cremation as her path. As of 2016, cremations outpaced traditional burials in America significantly. You can look at this article by Josh Sanborn, The New American Way of Death. Burning the body upon death would suggest that the body is meaningless without the soul. or could suggest that. If there is no sanctity in the body, then of course people want to do burial in the most cost-effective way, just destroying the body. On the complete other end of the spectrum, we have burial approaches such as mummification, which are premised on the belief that the body is so holy and so sacred that it should be preserved as long as possible. The Jewish approach is to allow the body to take its course. Do nothing to hasten the decay of the body. Do nothing to prevent the decay, nor slowing it down. From dust we come, to dust we return, as we learn in Ecclesiastes 3:21. In this practice, I see a mediation between extremes. Yes, the soul has left the body. Yes, the body has a vehicle for the soul. Yes, the body has lost enormous value upon death. After all, we have very few moral obligations to a deceased body. Religious obligations, absolutely, but very few moral obligations. When a person is alive, when there's a soul in that body, we have enormous moral obligations. So we can say that a corpse has lost enormous value. And yet there's still dignity we show to a person whose soul has departed. There's prohibitions against desecrating a corpse, benefiting from a corpse, or even delaying burial. Therefore, in Jewish tradition, the body is more than simply what the soul is not. Another personal reflection at being at the my mother's bed at the end, it's just a remarkably fast transition. Any of us who have been at end-of-life situations, just a remarkably fast transition from the moments of last breath where you experience someone alive to a few minutes later when you experience that person you love now breathless, to 30 minutes later, maybe an hour later, maybe 2 hours later, where you see that person's body being put into a bag and being wheeled out, in a bag that resembles a garbage bag, just a long black bag typically. A large man, that's not always large, not always a man, but somebody who's capable of just handling it like it's just dead weight, literally dead weight. It's just an incredibly strange transition. Oh, Nona says that they're losing me occasionally. Are other people, am I going in and out for people here? Oh,
yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Not sure why. I guess we have an internet issue. All right.
It freezes. You get frozen for a bit.
Oh, okay. So you lost a number of things I said. So, okay. When I wrap up in 2 minutes, please let me know if there was something I was in the middle of sharing that you want me to repeat. Just to complete that last thought, I was sharing how rapid the transition is from being alive to being deceased to now being just moved into a bag, and how quickly that transition can feel to someone who's still attached to that person. The theology of reincarnation is an interesting complication to the Jewish approach to the soul. Of course, Judaism is far from the only religion with a principle of reincarnation. Hinduism, Jainism, Druze, and others all emphasize some form of soul rebirth. The concept of soul migration emerges in mystical Jewish thought as well, where reincarnation is called Gilgul Neshamot, literally cycle of souls. Such a belief is so interesting because it's fairly opposed to the mainstream Jewish theology of Olam Haba, the world to come, in which our souls leave our bodies when we die and go to the world of souls. Rather, reincarnation asserts that your soul almost immediately migrates into a new body. The soul, we can learn from this system, requires a body. Interesting. We can imagine how the concept of Gilgul Neshamot might guide us into an awareness of the future beyond our lifetimes. Climate change, for example, is certainly affecting us in our lifetimes, but much of the action we need to urgently take today is for the sake of future descendants we will never meet. We may find it impossible to engender more empathy and urgency towards climate change, that our soul will be in a future body, one living in the world we are creating or destroying today, gives us a vehicle to be personally and morally concerned for the future. Of course, climate change matters deeply, even if it's not happening directly to us. But most of us need help getting there mentally, as it's hard to hold empathy for the so far into the future. Reincarnation could offer such a path. Separate from the idea of reincarnation and its alternative Olam Haba is the idea that in Yemei HaMashiach, the days of the Messiah, the world of souls will descend back into previous bodies to experience the messianic age of this world. On that day, everyone will return, the theology shares. So friends, to conclude, what does this all mean to us? It means, I think, that we can come to an understanding about our theology as Jews, that it's overly simplistic to say our theology is just this worldly, a phrase that gets batted around quite a bit. And it's also perhaps overly simplistic to say our theology is primarily otherworldly. Instead, Judaism offers us a theology that is both this worldly and otherworldly. Judaism offers us much that shapes how we believe in the now. Our religious legal codes, halakha, however we understand it, are geared toward how we behave and treat other people in this world. What's more, we have many social justice commitments and moral duties within the society that we live in. And yet we also must find ways to transcend this world and zoom out beyond all the immediate pressing concerns of our time. In other words, the state of the body should lead a fight to change this world for the better. However, the consciousness of the soul should give us a sense of submitting to a higher will. At times, we must surrender to the world that already exists, rather than working for the world that could be. This surrender is called rest. We rest when we can say, I can't change the world right now. I just need to take care of myself. Rest is sacred. 6 days of the week, we try to impact the world. We work, we write, we build, we create change. On the seventh day of Shabbat, we do none of these things in theory. We rest, and in resting, we move to new spiritual heights. In the cycle of the week, in the care of deceased bodies, in the movement of souls, in the caring of others, we may find countless opportunities to tend to the transcendent, concordant music of the body and the soul. I would love to hear from you on this topic of the body and the soul. And again, I think part of what makes a Jewish insight to the world a Jewish insight to the world is partially that it precedes other cultures from potentially offering it. It's partially how central it is to our thinking, and it's partially how radically different it is from other camps. And part of what I've tried to suggest here is that our other friends in other religions often take a much more body-centric approach or much more soul-centric approach as opposed to this harmonization approach. Okay, Lauren Blatt up in Canada. Nice to hear from you.
Hi, I've been away for a while taking another class. Anyways, hi everybody and Chag Sameach. What really has always, well, from my experience, Nebuch, with losing, being with a friend who passed away while I was there and my mom, Judaism really treats the body with such respect even after death. I mean, there has to be a Jewish person who's there until you hand them off to the person who comes from the funeral home, and they have a shomer who sits with the body until the funeral, and it really impresses me. And even to the extent, my mother unfortunately had an amputation, lost a leg, And the same thing, somebody came with it until the leg could be buried into her grave. So it's, although we have this beautiful harmonization, there's something soulful about the way we treat the body after death.
Yeah, thank you, Lauren. There's a lot to say there, but just briefly, I think firstly, I want to remind us that the Torah source for treating the body with respect actually emerges from someone who is given the death penalty, right? Oh. A murderer who is killed for being a murderer is immediately buried upon dying that we say, even though this person was deserving of the death penalty, what, of course, death penalty in Jewish thought is much more complicated, but in the biblical ethos, this person who is killed is then given immediate burial. And one of the things we learn there is halanat hamet, the prohibition of delaying burial, not to mention hana'at hamet, as opposed to halanat hamet, with the benefit from the corpse. And so, yes, that's true. I also want to remind us that in Kabbalistic thought, the soul does not ascend, so to speak, immediately upon death. The soul actually waits until burial to ascend. That's part of the urgency for burial. I know outside of the Orthodox world, it's much more lenient to give a few days for burial if needed. As you may know, in the Haredi world, in the ultra-Orthodox world, they go as fast as they can. I mean, sometimes family members can't even get there in time. They do it so fast. Because they want to make sure that burial is almost immediate. So, and in other cases, that soul is actually hovering a little bit longer, even beyond. So my kids, I once perhaps made the mistake of telling my kids that idea. And now whenever we see a dead animal on the side of the road, they are obsessed with ensuring we bury that animal so that soul can ascend. And I've been debating, because if we're riding our bike, I don't always want to bury a bird. I've been debating whether to follow their lead on that spiritual idea or whether to kind of challenge it a little so we can enjoy our bike ride. But okay, thank you so much, Lauren. Hi, Stan Hammerman.
Hi, Shmuley. I have a three-part question or comment.
Great.
The first one is, I want to know if there's any more or less uniformly definition of a soul in Judaism. Number two, when was the concept of soul first described or taught about in Judaism?
Great.
And number three, borrowing from Descartes, we can't perceive the soul. What proof do we have that it exists? Other than that, those are the only three questions I have.
Oh. Okay, only hard-hitting ones there, Stan. Amazing. All right, so on the first question, a definition of the soul, I would recommend a book for those who are interested in that subject by Rabbi Adin Seinzaltz, who actually has a book called Soul, where he kind of goes throughout Jewish thought. It's a pretty easy and short read. And he goes throughout Jewish thought and lays out a few hundred different approaches. As we know, there's no uniform approach, a few hundred different approaches as how the soul has been understood throughout different thoughts. Now, I want to remind us also that in Jewish thought, there's no one soul. There's five souls, right? I mean, just to start with the first three that we might know more commonly, we have the Ruach, we have neshama, we have nefesh, then we have chaya and yechida. So there are five different levels of soul, actually, almost like five different levels of consciousness. And with those five different levels of consciousness, those five different souls, so to speak, they operate on very different planes of reality. In fact, in Kabbalah, they call it olamot. They exist in different worlds. It's funny, my five-year-old son thinks of, I mean, if we go on a plane, we're going to a different world. So whenever we get on a plane, he says, what world are we going to? You know, in any case, so there's these five different souls, and the common understandings of what they are, just to throw out a few, someone like Maimonides, inspired by Aristotle, really thinks the soul is the mind. The soul is an intellectual space. God is a philosopher for Rambam. And so the best place to access the soul is in the life of philosophy, in the life of the mind, which is very different than a mystic who understands that the soul is found in breath. As a reminder, the word neshama, soul, is connected to nishima, the word for breath. So it's in breath that the soul exists. That's why when we die and we stop breathing, the soul departs. Or departs the body, even if it's hovering above a little bit. So now we have the philosophical approach that the soul is intellectual, the mystic approach that is actually it's beyond the realm of thought, It's actually transcending the realm of thought in the experience of breath. Then we have the experience that it's actually not, it's otherworldly from the start. Soul is God, right? The soul is God. It's the part of godliness within the human being, you know, so to speak. You know, and then to be sure, there are those who conflate body and soul, right? That actually the entirety of the person is the soul of a person, right? That's, right. I am my soul. There is no difference between my body and soul. Like that's the entire, it's almost conflated. So anyways, much more to say about that amazing first question, but to go on to the second one, where does the soul begin? Right there in the creation story in Genesis. Where we see the notion of ruach, and we see the notion of God breathing this breath of life into this ruach into the first humans, and that is the first being that is created that is considered to have this divine dimension to them, and so that's normally the first idea that's kind of pointed to there. In terms of that third question on Descartes and existence, wow, this is one of those cases where it's hard to know what direction to take here. So I hope others will engage with this great question as well. I am not here to sell the soul. I'm not here to, to sell that we know the soul exists, or I could tell you where to find it. Like all of us, I'm also a seeker trying to find this. And I think the question is similar to, is there a God? I don't think it would be so easy to believe in a soul and not a God, or to believe in a God and not a soul. And the question is similar to, do we believe in the capacity for love? No one can prove they love someone. I see Stan and Cheryl sitting in the, in that kitchen together next to each other, married for a number of decades, but they know they love each other. Can they prove it to me? Can I prove it to you? No, but there's something deeply within them that they know that. So too, there's things that we know that we can't prove. That are so deeply within us. And the question is, have we had that experience? Have we experienced something within us that goes beyond the body experience, assuming we think the soul is beyond? There is a whole, I don't want to put this down because a lot of people take this really appreciate this. And I also don't want to build it up because a lot of people, find it to be hocus pocus. But there's a bunch of literature out there about people who suggest they have died and returned and experienced similar things. The notion that there can be an experience of having hovered above one's own dead body. And I obviously can't speak to that. I have had a number of spiritual experiences in my life beyond the body. But what I find amazing about Judaism is that one could deny the soul, one could deny God, or be agnostic towards both, and still live the most deeply rich of Jewish lives, living by Jewish values and within Jewish culture and the like. And that's really unique for a spiritual tradition. Yes, I do think, again, as I'm suggesting here, something is deeply enhanced by the wedding of these two dimensions of the self. However, I think the other side is less true. I think that one could live a deeply richly Jewish life, denying the soul and embracing the significance of the body, but not the opposite. I think it would be a distortion of Judaism to prioritize the soul and diminish any value of human suffering and the value of the body. So even though I'm wedding the two, I do think that that one extreme is more of a distortion than the other. Okay, that was such an unfair answer to three amazing questions, but that's me scratching the surface. Okay, over to Aglaya and then Nona.
Okay, so first I was the one who actually said we're neither. That actually came from a dream that I had one time though, in the dream, for whatever reason, I ended up screaming at someone, God's the one who made you, so you beg them to tell you who you are and everything. So after that though, my answer became neither. Now, this is just throwing this out there, responding to Julius Lester. Okay. So hold on. This is the part when she's the main character is talking about like the fact that she wasn't an accident when she was a child and she has a limp for the rest of her life, basically. Okay. Why did Dennis need to know what hurt her? Why had it not been enough for him to know, to simply know that she hurt? She thought she knew the reason because she had seen the look on his face too many times. That look that said, if I knew what was hurting you, I know I could fix it. Men, or maybe it was just American men, were accustomed to fixing things as if that was their God-given duty. Rebecca resented the presumption that all wounds could be healed. They could not. Some wounds were reminders, if you allowed them to be. Now, I don't know if anyone wants to respond to Julius Lester there, though, but I know that I've had a similar experience with that. She didn't want prosthetics for her limping because it was like a constant like reminder to God, you did this to me. Now, I did have a similar experience to that myself, though. I never got plastic surgery for any of the scars that I had. But anyway, though, and yes, those scars actually came from self-injury. Okay, so anyway, we'll just put that out in the open, okay? But it was kind of like also, though, I needed that reminder of, okay, this is where you were and this is where you are now. So, but I just kind of wondered, though, like with the idea of whatever wounds you have on your body, like serving as a reminder, not only to yourself, though, but also a reminder to God, because that's another thing that she's doing, a reminder to God of, okay, this is what, you know, you're responsible to. You are responsible for this, too. So.
Okay. Thank you so much. That's so interesting what you're saying around, yeah, scars on the body as a bearing witness or a testimony towards the divine. Wow, so much to say about that and think about that. And I'm gonna leave it for folks to think about and respond to. But picking up on something else that you kind of inspired in what you were sharing in the beginning, Aglaya, I think that there's this question around permanency, like a scar on the body and kind of the permanent mark that makes, or the permanent scar of on the soul. You know, there's a story that my children love bedtime stories, and so I spend time each day thinking about the stories I'm going to share. And the one that I intend to share next is connected to this. There's a father whose child has a temper problem. And so the father says to the child that every time that the child has demonstrated their temper, that they should go and hammer a nail into the fence in the backyard. And so slowly, maybe you've heard this before, it's a relatively well-known story. And so over time, as the child continues to hammer nails into the fence, the child begins to control their temper a little more because it takes time to go get the hammer and get the nail and go to the backyard. It's a little embarrassing. And after hitting 45 nails into the fence, no political implications with the 45 involved over there, in nailing the hammer into the fence, the child learns to control their temper. And at this point, the father says to the child, go take the hammer, and I want you to pull all those nails out of the fence. And the child does it. And the parent shows them the holes and says, yes, even if you've now learned to conquer that temper, I want to show you the holes that can never be filled that have been left in that fence, right? That there are scars we create in other people and scars that are in ourselves that never go away. And there are some moves we make in our lives that are in fact permanent, even though we talked about, that repair is possible. Repair is possible. That doesn't mean scars go away. And so the challenge here is what those scars continue, how do we continue to make meaning of them as we evolve? And how do we make meaning of other people's scars? And how do we continue to learn who we are and who others are? And, I saw that I was talking with somebody who's on the Zoom right now earlier this morning about a study I read recently that said the longer you're married, the more you think you know your partner, but actually the less you know them, because you believe they're this person that you knew X number of years ago, but actually they continue to change in ways that you haven't really come to understand fully. And that's also kind of true for ourselves. We have a 75-year-old body, but we still kind of think of ourselves as 45. We're a 45-year-old body, but we still think of ourselves as 25 in some sense, right? So too with the soul. We may have had some relationship to our soul when we were 18 or 38, and yet we're still relating to it like that. even though we're decades beyond that age. And sometimes those scars are can be a little bit of reminders for where we once were and where we once stood. And yet they can also be distractions because we're not those people anymore. So anyways, that was a little long-winded, but I'm glad you said so much more, and I'm sorry I didn't, but I hope others will engage with you often. Thank you so much. Hi, Nona. Nona, and then David.
I wanted to just ask, you alluded a little bit to this, talking about the birds, the bird that you didn't want to bury, or wondering about whether you had a responsibility to that bird. But I'm curious what Judaism teaches about the soul energy in things that are not human, because it feels like, and I just saw an interesting article in a scientific reference to some reference about consciousness of inanimate things like rocks and things, that there is measures and there's new science around consciousness beyond, just human consciousness. And so I'm just curious, my sense of godliness is a connection to all matter and all creatures, not just, and a responsibility for them, not just what does the human get out of it. So I'm just curious what Judaism really teaches around soulfulness in a sense beyond humans.
Yeah, great, Nona. Thank you for sharing that. And thankfully here, we have a great approach for Jewish rationalists and a great approach for Jewish those who reach who lean mystically. For those who are rationalists, they have the approach of really having a binary here, that there's the holy and the mundane, right? There is the spiritual and the physical, and there is the lofty human who is created in the image of God, and all the rest of creation, which is far below that, in a very anthropocentric worldview. And for those who that speaks to them, they have that tradition to follow. And for those like you who experience soul energy beyond human beings, be it from animals, non-human animals, or from the earth or the like, we have a very rich tradition in this path as well. There's a massive industry that has emerged in regards to pet burial and pet mourning practices. It's become more and more common that I get questions, can I say Kaddish for my dog? And I know some people that sounds obvious. Of course, I'm going to say Kaddish for my dog. And other people, it sounds offensive, like Kaddish is for people. And so there is this whole range of issues. And most certainly in Kabbalah, animals have souls, very different than human souls, to be sure. And animals, there's even Kabbalistic sources that talk about, the afterlife as it relates to the animal kingdom. In terms of energy, I think there's a little bit less to offer there. In terms of tapping into that that kind of energy that exists. But Nona, I'm glad to hear that. And I do have some sources, if you're interested, from some of the Kabbalistic literature I can share with you that look at that issue of animal souls. As a reminder, in the beginning of... let me actually bracket that. That's a complicated... it's going to take us too far down a different path. So, I think what I said suffices for now, but Nona, to be continued in conversation. Yes, David, and then Cheryl.
Yeah, I think I have maybe the experience of everyone else that I do feel young inside. I don't know, am I 35, am I 30, who knows? Right. But I value and celebrate all of the wrinkles and the wisdom in my body. I'm glad I have laugh wrinkles and cry wrinkles, and there is that interesting combination. But one of my 10, top 10 Jewish ideas, I think, is God created a pure soul, Elohai neshama shenatat bish tehorahi. And being a gay guy, that was so important, that positive lesson that I'm okay, even though the world thinks maybe I'm not okay. And I really credit, my parents, yes, and the positivity of Judaism that helped me along the way. So great stuff.
David, I'm so glad you shared that. Thank you. Because actually, And now I'm going beyond anything you said, because if I say anything sensitive, it's not in response to what you just said. But a lot of the people that I had the chance to work with who were in recovery, struggling from addiction, were actually people from religious fundamentalist faiths, where because of their LGBTQ orientation, they hated themselves and hated their bodies and felt enormous guilt and shame that they wore different. And actually a big healing factor for them was a return to this notion of the purity of their soul. That when they found themselves addicts and they hated their bodies and they hated their desires and this and that, they were able to heal through this return to the notion that within them there was something perfect, even though they felt themselves to be so broken. And so I actually think this notion of the purity of the soul is not only beautiful and powerful, but morally robust in terms of what we can offer people who are going through a healing journey. And so that's the first thing. And because I'm saying something more sensitive, David, I'm gonna give you the chance to respond to me after if you'd like. You know, and I think the other thing as it relates to of body and soul here is how much a queer person should cherish that dimension of themselves as divinely ordained, divinely destined, because it's not only the power of the pure soul that is divine, the origin of the body, which is divine. And the fact that I was born as a gay man, right, means that is part of kind of how God created my body, and my body is sacred too. And so I want to cherish this aspect of the pure soul for one who's struggling with their body, but also say to that queer person, it's also your body, which is part of kind of the divine plan. As let me pause there. David, you want to respond at all to that? Or?
Just quickly. Yes, I agree. And the other side of the coin, like you said, is that God created me as I am. So, you know, my desires, my this, my that, and to honor that, just like we all, you know, we are created in God's image, but he created each of us as a unique person. So our job, one of our jobs, is to discover who we are and to honor that. That wonderful story when the Rebbe went to heaven and he said, I'm not Moses, I'm not this one, that one. And God said, I didn't want you to be any of those people. I wanted you to be you.
Great. Yes, thank you for that. I love that. Yes, exactly. It's a great story. And I think that one of the damages that many religious faiths have inflicted upon the body is, as I quoted from a source earlier, is this notion that the desires of the body are something to be ashamed of, right? That sexual desires are something shameful, or being hungry, or whatever the desires are, right? I think many traditions have taken that approach, that human desire is our weakness to overcome and to conquer. It's our Yetzer Hara, right? And I think Judaism does, in its best form, does a lovely job of elevating desire rather than smashing it down, of saying desire is a powerful thing, sexual desire, desire for food, desire for wealth, desire for selfhood, desire for identity. These types of desires are not something to be embarrassed about. Just live in the soul and the ideals beyond the body, right? These temptations squash it down, but actually are something that are part of deeply who we are. Thank you, David. Over to you, Cheryl.
It would seem to me that I feel that I'm part, you know, a combination of body and soul. I don't understand quite the prohibition against organ donor, you know, preserving the body for burial and or cremation, whatever. My dad, who is still very much alive, has told me for years that he wants to be cremated. It wouldn't be my choice, but this is his choice. But I also wonder about organ donor and helping, you know, you're helping a person beyond death. Your soul, that would be like your soul would be helping someone you know, who's still very much an earthly being. It's a combination that I don't understand the prohibition against, except when you say, well, we have to preserve for Olam Haba, maybe. I'm not exactly sure why, when it seems that it would be a Jewish tenet to help those in need, which God and all of us know you certainly subscribe to.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much, Cheryl. So to share what you already know, but to go just a step further. So in general, the concept of organ donation, all denominations, Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, are on board that organ donation is permitted in general. Very few go so far to say it's obligated. There have been a few sources that suggest there is a mitzvah or an obligation to do so. But most say you don't have to, but it is certainly a good thing and permitted, both while alive, when possible, but certainly after death. Where things get a little more complicated are on the issue of when death occurs, just like the issue of when life begins, as we see from the 1864 Arizona law, which has now been revived, that life begins at conception, which is, just to be on the record, I find to be incredibly troubling and damaging, and something that we should be combated against. But as my friend Stan suggests, it might be politically beneficial. In any case, when life begins and when death occurs, and whether it's the cessation of heartbeat, or whether it is the death of the brainstem, and of course when how many organs are still able to be donated if you take a more strict approach there, and that becomes the larger issue, is when death occurs, and so I'm so glad you raised that, because I think it's another example where we want to do all we can to preserve life within the person, but also within other people who need those organs, and so it gets a little complicated. The other complication emerges with directly saving life versus donation to science. The Reform and Conservative movement largely would look favorably upon the idea of a body donated to science, of course, with some exceptions, but I think those would be the mainstream views. Orthodoxy would reject a body donated towards science. Organs could only be donated if it's going to directly save a life immediately. However, there is an article by Rabbi Yitz Greenberg and Rabbi Zev Farber out of the Orthodox movement that take a utilitarian approach and say you might actually save more lives in theory by donating to science than donating directly. And so they take a permissive approach, but they're definitely in the minority. In any case, so much more to say there, but I know we're at time. So let's hear Gary Friedlander quick, and then we'll wrap it up here.
Very quick. I've studied acupuncture for quite a while. And it's interesting to go back to Aglaia about scars. So in acupuncture, physical scars also prevent chi or life force from rotating and creating a healthy body. And those always have to be treated, though they're never, the scars, though they may be external, never ever are completely resolved on the internal side by creating, by stopping the life force, or what they call chi, which, kind of goes back to what Aglaia was talking about. So.
Mm. Okay. Anyway, very interesting. Thank you so much. Yeah. Awesome. Thank you. And Nona, what a great question over there. I wish we had 15 minutes for some transgender theology. Maybe we'll get into that in one of the other sessions. And also Judy Schaffert, your other great comment over there. I'm sorry we won't get to those today. Friends, we're going to be off the next two Tuesdays because of Pesach, both Tuesdays. And so we're going to pick up, what is it, May 4th, did we say? Let me look it right here. May 7th. We'll be off on April 23rd and 30th and pick up again on May 7th with Session 5. I want to wish everyone a meaningful Pesach, all who observe. That not only should it be a time of good food and songs and great conversations about the Haggadah and nostalgia for our parents and grandparents who have passed away, but also a time for us to think about how we're going to bring liberation to the world for ourselves, for our people in America, in the Middle East, around the world? What can we do, even small, to help bring freedom to the world? Have a great day. Tak sameach. See you soon.